Order, order.
Hello, I'm Hinea Ahu, bringing you the Week in Parliament with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon. And no surprise that the week was dominated by the presentation of the budget, the seventh from Bill English as National's Finance Minister. He and his Prime Minister, John Key, were bombarded with questions about it on Tuesday and Wednesday, but the opposition, like everyone else, had to wait until 2pm on Thursday when, as Tom Fruin reports, they got more than they bargained for.
A long week in the House after the government took urgency to push through five bills from the seventh budget that its Finance Minister, Bill English, delivered on Thursday.
Delivering this budget is only possible because of the constructive working relationships National has with the Māori Party, ACT and United Future. I want to acknowledge their continuing support and contribution to stable government.
That contribution being their four votes, which, added to National's 59, gives John Key's minority government the numbers to pass the budget, put the House under urgency and defeat the no-confidence amendment at the end of the 15-hour budget debate launched on Thursday by opposition leader Andrew Little.
Mr Speaker, I move that all the words after that be deleted and replaced with, "This House has no confidence in a government which has failed to deliver the jobs, the incomes or the real surplus they promised, squandered the golden economic."
The opposition leader's traditional response to the budget earned the equally predictable comment from the Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, that was singularly the worst reply speech from a leader of the opposition this Parliament has heard. This man, Mr Andrew Little, is like one of the least favoured candidates or contestants on The Bachelor. He knows he's never getting a rose, that boy. That was Andrew Little, and the operative word is little.
While John Key played the man, Winston Peters had a ball putting the budget to music.
This is a split ends budget. Everywhere you look, there are deficits, and as split ends, the group sang, "I see red, I see red, I see red."
The New Zealand First leader saw red, but Greens co-leader Materia Toure felt blue.
Today, Mr Speaker, children in this country, children in poverty, needed a game changer. But instead, the Prime Minister chose to do the barest minimum for the poorest children and to abandon the hopes of our younger generations.
In contrast to Materia Toure, Māori Party co-leader Te Uruua Flavel was more than happy with the budget.
Mr Speaker, can I firstly start off by congratulating the Minister of Finance for working extremely well with the Māori Party leadership. And it's sad that some will moan because they got nothing. They delivered nothing to the people of this country, and the Māori Party has been able to work constructively with the National Party throughout this last year. Mr Speaker, I'm usually a humble man, as most people know. I'm very humble, Mr Speaker, but not today, Mr Speaker. I'm ready to rumble today because the Māori Party has helped deliver some goodies to the people of this country.
The backslapping carried on when Mr Flavel was followed by United Future's Peter Dunn.
Mr Speaker, can I begin by congratulating my colleague to my right for his impassioned address and for the contribution that he makes to this government. And I must say also, with respect to David Seymour to my left, the three support partners work remarkably closely together. We don't always agree on issues, but we take a common approach on a number of things, and I find it a real pleasure working alongside these colleagues to achieve real gains for the people of New Zealand. And that's what this budget is all about.
The love-in between the government's three support parties continued with the ACT member for Epsom, David Seymour.
Could I also tribute the fabulous speakers that went before me, and I reiterate what Peter Dunn says, that I greatly enjoy working with the other support parties. Kia ora and thank you. I also would like to pay tribute to the Minister of Finance, following on from what Peter Dunn said. He is a man with a heart and with a vision, and is changing the way government operates from handing money out here, there and everywhere to having government as an organisation focused on outcomes.
David Seymour, Peter Dunn, Mr Flavel and Marama Fox then joined National in voting to interrupt the budget debate to put the House under urgency. Their formal agreements to support the government on motions of money supply, confidence and procedure producing this result.
Members, the ayes are 63, the noes are 58. The motion is agreed to.
Deputy Speaker Chester Burrows was to hear those numbers, 63 and 58, many more times as he chaired the House sitting as a committee, resuming at 9 on Friday morning to debate the second bill in the urgency motion, the Social Housing Reform, Flexible Purchasing and Remedial Matters Bill.
Don't interrupt me while I'm on my feet. I'm the chair of this session and you are not.
Mr Burrows eventually lost patience with New Zealand First MP Ron Mark.
Member Ron Mark will leave the chamber. He's been here a long time. He knows that votes had called in silence. He was reminded of that and he decided to interject on three times, casting aspersions on people who voted a particular way. He will leave the chamber. Members, the ayes are 63, the noes are 58.
And so Ron Mark became the second MP ordered out this week. Labour's Grant Robertson was thrown out by David Carter on Wednesday for interjecting while the Speaker was on his feet.
When I'm on my feet and I call for silence, and then a member specifically after being warned not to interject does so, he leaves me no choice but to be severe.
Mr Carter had warned Grant Robertson after Labour's finance spokesman had put this question to the Minister of Finance, Bill English, for the fourth time.
Is it correct that Treasury advised him that a surplus for 2015-16 is only possible if there is a significant rebound in global dairy prices?
And Mr English also repeated his answer for a fourth time.
The member will just have to wait one more sleep to find out. Speaker, the member will just have to wait till tomorrow. Oh, Mr Speaker, the member will have to wait till tomorrow. Well, he will have to wait till tomorrow. The member will have to wait till tomorrow.
But Grant Robertson didn't think he should have to wait until Mr English delivered his budget.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
Point of order.
How is that an answer addressing that question? It's about advice he has received. He can't tell me to wait till tomorrow. Amazingly enough, the Treasury do give him advice. He ignores it most of the time.
Mr Carter agreed that the Finance Minister could have done better.
It would have been a more satisfactory answer if it had been answered directly by the Minister. But at the end of the day, I am not responsible for the answers that are given by any minister in this House. Ministers themselves are responsible. They'll be judged both by this House and by the public.
While not responsible for ministers' answers, the Speaker was the sole judge of their content, as Mr Carter explained to Labour's David Cunliffe.
Speaker, what is the definition of addressing the question?
Order. I adjudge that on every occasion, depending on the context and content of the question, the context and the content of the answer. I'm the one who makes that judgment.
And Mr Carter's judgment was soon challenged again when Social Development Minister Ann Tolley gave a similar answer to this question from Labour's Jacinda Ardern.
Does she stand by her statement in December last year in relation to child poverty that the government is, quote, working on a comprehensive plan and it is shaping up to be a really big piece of work, end quote? If so, will that big piece of work be in Budget 2015?
Honourable Ann Tolley.
Mr Speaker, yes, and the member will have to wait until tomorrow.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary to the Minister. How many times have ministers met to discuss the child poverty plans in the 2015 budget, given in December she claimed they were meeting weekly?
Honourable Ann Tolley.
Heaps.
This time it was Labour's Chief Whip, Chris Hipkins, who sought an explanation from Mr Carter.
The Speaker's rulings and standing orders only provide one out for ministers, and that is to say that giving an answer is not in the public interest. The budget does not actually provide an out. If the ministers are indicating it's not in the public interest, order. They should say so. But somebody saying wait until a certain date order. Isn't an answer.
Order. I've been in this House on many occasions in the week leading up to a budget, and many ministers of finance. I can think of one called Dr Michael Cullen, who on many occasions, to many questions asked by an opposition, said he'll have to wait until the budget's delivered.
That was on Wednesday when the House completed the second reading of a bill that had been on the government's order paper for just under 6 years. It's the Radio New Zealand Amendment Bill, containing a revised charter, which had come from a select committee in 2009 and had been waiting for a second reading, although that didn't faze Broadcasting Minister Amy Adams.
Even iconic institutions must adapt to the modern age or else they will grow irrelevant and eventually fade. And that's why this government is progressing this bill, to future-proof our public broadcaster, for years to come.
The bill is much the same as it was when reported back from the committee rooms, although Amy Adams indicated some changes will be made when it's debated with the whole House sitting as a committee.
Mr Speaker, I do want to signal that I've been asked by Radio New Zealand to undertake clarification at the Committee of the Whole stage to make clear that while Radio New Zealand services must remain commercial free, this does not prevent them from taking advantage of opportunities such as, for example, their recent presence on iHeartRadio, which is, of course, in itself a commercial app that includes advertising, or licensing their content for reuse by commercial providers. At the same time, changes would also need to be made to the commencement date of the bill.
And while the Radio New Zealand Amendment Bill had its second reading, two other bills, the Environmental Reporting Bill and the Standards and Accreditation Bill, barely survived the same stage by just one vote when the Māori Party voted with the opposition, giving them 60, just one fewer than the government with ACT and United Future on 61. Meanwhile, on the day that John Key delivered one of the two speeches that he makes each year in the debating chamber, he was being used in one of the committee rooms as an example of the difficulties facing the media when reporting suicides.
What if the, I'm sorry to use this example, it could be anybody else, if the Prime Minister was found dead of a gunshot wound by his car, wound to the head, what can the press report if it's got a suspicious look to it?
Law Commission President Sir Grant Hammond making a submission to the Justice and Electoral Select Committee on Thursday morning.
The media were interested. They said, we don't care what the restrictions are, we would report that. We would take our lumps if the law came down on us. I found that an interesting response. I thought it was unfortunate. The media is not free of the law, but it's a very good illustration of the highest sort of interest type of thing that one can find.
In a submission on the suicide reporting amendments and the Coroner's Amendment Bill, currently before the committee, Sir Grant said the Law Commission favoured minimal restrictions, except in reporting the method or cause of the sudden death, with the only person able to speak on that being the Chief Coroner.
And that would be in the public interest. I'm back to my Prime Minister example, when everybody in the country would be screaming to know, you know, just what happened here.
Sir Grant Hammond followed the Director of Mental Health, Dr John Crawshaw, who told committee members that publication of a method for suicide could have a dangerous influence on young people.
We've got one of the highest in the OECD countries of rates of youth suicide, and we really have to do things to turn that around. And once it becomes legitimised for young people that a way of ending their pain is to take certain methods, then it becomes almost endemic within their culture. And unfortunately, having looked at the number of the clusters that we have had in New Zealand, that has been very evident in terms of a common method which has become publicised and promoted amongst that group as a way of ending their life.
The day before making that submission to the Justice and Electoral Committee on the Coroner's Amendment Bill, Dr Crawshaw led a briefing on youth mental health social services to the Social Services Committee, where he faced this question from the committee's Deputy Chairman, Matt Ducey.
First, can I just say how excited I am to be talking about mental health. I think that we will all have good and bad mental health over our life, so we're all in this together. And the best line I've heard is that there's a fine line between provider and consumer. How do we track against international benchmarking? Do we have better mental health for young people in New Zealand?
Dr Crawshaw said mental disorder typically started in adolescence and early 20s.
The incidence of mental illness, we typically say 1 in 5 will have a mental health problem or challenge in a given year. Only 3% of those people will have the severe end requiring specialist services, and that's in the adult space.
The Director of Mental Health, Dr John Crawshaw, briefing the Social Services Committee, while back at the Justice and Electoral Committee, Lewis Holden from the New Flag New Zealand lobby explained why they opposed the call for a yes-no referendum first, similar to the method used in deciding whether to change the electoral system.
With a flag, it's a visual thing. It is a physical thing. It's not something that can be easily described in a piece of paper. So when you're asking a simple yes-no question, the problem is people will be inclined to say no, and that's exactly why, of course, a large number of people are arguing for that, because they don't know what the alternative is. And that's why the alternatives need to be up front. What we saw with the MMP referendum, where you had a yes-no question up front, was actually a large number of people didn't vote in the second question.
Lewis Holden from the New Flag New Zealand Group.
Thanks, Tom. Before we hear what happened during urgency, here's the mystery voice.
The Week in Parliament. Mystery voice.
And to use one of Tana Umanga's memorable phrases, we ain't here to play tiddlywinks.
Who is the mystery voice and what is he talking about? Here it is again.
The Week in Parliament. Mystery voice.
And to use one of Tana Umanga's memorable phrases, we ain't here to play tiddlywinks.
I'll be back with the identity of the mystery voice later in the program. Now, back to Tom and what happened over the weekend.
They finally went home at 8:08 on Saturday night, just under 29 hours spent under urgency. That took total hours spent in the chamber to 43.75 last week, more than twice the normal sitting week of 17 hours. After sitting till 10 p.m. on Thursday, when they usually knock off at 6, they were back in the chamber at 9 on Friday morning and went through till midnight with just an hour off for lunch and dinner, then resumed at 9 again on Saturday morning, continuing on until 9:52 p.m. In that time, they debated the first reading of the Support for Children and Hardship Bill. Then they passed four bills through all their stages. They were the Social Housing Reform, Flexible Purchasing and Remedial Matters Bill, the Telecommunications Development Levy Amendment Bill, the KiwiSaver Budget Measures Bill, and the Border Processing Arrivals and Departures Levy Bill. The first bill was sent to the Social Services Committee, but the others didn't leave the chamber and were not open to public submissions. Most contentious were the Social Housing Reform Bill and the measure ending the $1,000 KiwiSaver Kickstart incentive. They were opposed by all other parties except National and its three support parties and passed by 63 votes to 56. The lack of public input into those bills was raised frequently as the opposition used every argument in the book to drag out debate, frequently raising the blood pressure of the Deputy Speaker, Chester Burrows.
Don't interrupt me while I'm on my feet. I'm the chair of this session and you are not.
Deputy Speaker Chester Burrows under pressure in the chamber this morning after the House resumed at 9 under urgency and began a slow crawl through the second bill in the government's urgency motion. Debate on the Social Housing Reform, Flexible Purchasing and Remedial Matters Bill resumed with the House sitting as a committee. That's when it's more informal and MPs can speak more than once, opening up the potential for filibuster, in which one side, usually the opposition, speak for as long as they can and the other, usually the government, call on the chairman to cut off debate by putting the question to a vote.
Members, the motion is that the question be now put.
And so the protests begin, starting with Labour's Sue Moroney.
Mr. Chair, this is a substantial piece of legislation. There are several members on this side who have not been able to participate in this debate to date, and I request that you reconsider your ruling.
A similar appeal then from New Zealand First MP Ron Mark.
Mr Chair, look, this debate is quite a serious one for New Zealand First, and a number of our members have left their offices, come down here to take the opportunity to take call on this, and they have not been afforded that opportunity.
Thank you. I'm ready to rule on this matter. The question will be put. There have been 21 calls taken from the opposition. This is the third closure motion, and I'm going to put the motion.
First, though, this last-ditch call from Labour's Chief Whip.
Point of order, Chris Hipkins.
I won't make a long point of order, but I'll make three brief points. The first is that this bill is going through all stages under urgency, and it has not been to a select committee. The second point is there are members who have been seeking the call since the beginning of the debate who have not been given a call, while other members have been given multiple calls. And I think that that does create an unfairness in this process. And the third is that there has been a long tradition in the House that where the government actively don't engage in a debate, that is not used as a reason for closing down a debate prematurely.
But Chester Burrows was not swayed.
In ruling on the point of order, I am going to continue to put the motion. The fact is that the opposition have, all parties have the ability to be able to marshal who is going to speak. They all have the ability to make calls. Not every member who seeks a call on every debate does get a call. That is the history of it. And some of us go back quite a long way and remember how these things worked and have worked in the past. The most frustrating thing to be the chair in a debate such as this is that you think of your best lines while you're sitting here and you don't get the opportunity to do it. Having said that, I believe that on analysis, people will find that there have been significant numbers of calls. There have been many members who have had the opportunity to make their points, and the points being made are now becoming repetitive. So I'm going to put the motion. I'm not taking any more points of order.
Mr. Chair.
Please be seated. I'm not taking any more points of order on this matter. The motion will be put. The motion is that the question be now put. All those in favour will say aye.
Aye.
Those against will say no.
No.
The ayes have it. The noes have it. A party vote was called for. The clerk will conduct a party vote.
That takes up another minute and always with the same result.
Members, the ayes are 63, the noes are 58. The motion is agreed to.
And so on to the next part, eventually winding up over 5 hours later with the bill split into four for its third and final reading, launched on behalf of Social Housing Minister Paula Bennett by her Cabinet colleague Jo Goodhue.
This bill gives Ministry of Social Development flexibility in the way it enters agreements with social housing providers. It creates a ministerial direction power to allow the Minister of Social Housing, in consultation with other housing ministers, to authorise the Ministry of Social Development to enter into tailored agreements to purchase social housing. These new tailored agreements will enable MSD to look at contracts with tenants in mind and look for ways to get better housing services and better provision of social housing.
And on the other side of the chamber, Labour's housing spokesman Phil Twyford.
Pushing this bill through under budget urgency is a cynical abuse of this Parliament and its processes. There is no reason that we've heard last night or today from the ministers and the chair, from Jo Goodhue who just spoke, or any of the government members, why this bill has to be rammed through the House under urgency.
The responsibility for chairing debates during urgency was shared by the Deputy Speaker and his two assistant speakers, Lindsay Tish and Trevor Mallard, although it was Chester Burrows who had the final word on Saturday night.
Members, the question is that the motion be agreed to. Those of that opinion will say aye.
Aye!
To the contrary, no.
No!
The ayes have it. Order. The clerk will conduct a party vote in silence.
New Zealand National.
59 votes in favour.
New Zealand Labour.
21 votes opposed.
Green Party.
In silence. Order. Order. Not long to go. Order.
9 votes in favour.
New Zealand First.
12 votes opposed.
Maori Party.
2 votes in favour.
UGG New Zealand.
1 vote in favour.
United Future.
1 vote in favour.
Members, the ayes are 72, the noes are 33. The motion is agreed to.
Security Amendment Bill number 2, third reading. Customs Excise Amendment Bill number 2, third reading.
Members, it's not done, or it's a breach of convention for speakers to ever to be able to grade or rank the speeches that have occurred in the House. I would like to make a few reflections, though. We've seen a number of firsts in the House. We've seen the ejection from the House of a certain member making his mark as the long-suffering Deputy Speaker's first expulsion. But going to the Dr. Michael Cullen's Prize for Irrelevant History lesson goes to Chris Hipkins and the Belgian royal family. The I'm so pleased to be here in urgency goes to Deborah Adams, Chamber Officer, who was ecstatic this morning when I arrived, and she just said, I just love urgency. The Jill Pettis Prize for the most persistent interjections with 15 repeats of the same phrase in a 5-minute committee stage goes to David Clark. I woke myself up this morning at 4:15 screaming something about the worst in 50 years. The Asanati Lolly Taylor Paul Quinn Prize for volume in a speech goes to Ian Lees Galloway, which is self-evident. But I want to extend our thanks to Roland and Mary and their teams for the security staff, the chamber officers, Hansard, the cafeteria staff, for their extended duties. The fellow speakers would like to join with me too in thanking you all for the spirit in which you've engaged in the debate. Members, the House stands adjourned till 2 p.m. on Tuesday, the 26th of May.
Deputy Speaker Chester Burrows ending Budget Week urgency on a light note late on Saturday night.
Thanks, Tom. Now back to the Mystery Voice.
The Week in Parliament. Mystery Voice.
And to use one of Tana Umanga's memorable phrases, we ain't here to play tiddlywinks.
And that's the Trade Minister, Tim Grosser, answering this question from his Labor shadow, David Parker.
Does he stand by his description during the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations of the Canadian dairy industry as belonging, quotes, in the former Soviet Union?
Honourable Tim Grosser. Order.
Yes, because, Mr Parker, it's called a negotiation. And to use one of Tana Umanga's memorable phrases, we ain't here to play tiddlywinks.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Honourable David Parker.
Has he seen international media reports that his abrasive and arrogant negotiating approach has spawned a new urban slang term in Washington, D.C. for, quotes, counterproductive, undiplomatic sledging, that term being grossing? And how does he think, slagging off the Canadians using derogatory terms is going to result in a good outcome for those negotiations?
Order. Honourable Tim Grosser.
Well, unfortunately, I haven't seen those allegations, but I'm really interested to have a look at it. At least it might mean we're making a mark.
Point of order. Speaker, I seek leave to table a document by a Delaware-based policy analyst, Mary Bates, dated Thursday the 14th
order.
Of May.
Order!
Saying such incendiary fighting words clearly do nothing to assist Canadian diplomats help New Zealand help themselves.
The document's been described, I think it was dated.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Honourable David Parker.
Will he accept responsibility and admit he has poisoned the negotiation if it transpires that the TPP terms do not reduce tariffs on dairy products to Canada to similar levels as were achieved in the Chinese FTA?
Honourable
Mr.
David,
Speaker, Mr. Speaker, I'm prepared to make an offer to the member that if this negotiation is successfully concluded, I'll introduce him to the adult world of New Zealand and Canada on dairy over the last 30 years, where they have pitched their interests diametrically opposed to New Zealand's interests, and it takes just a little bit of spine to stand up to it.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Honourable David Parker.
Is the reason he doesn't think his insult of Canada has further damaged New Zealand's reputation in trade negotiations because he's already trashed it by using the GCSB to spy on the rivals for his WTO job?
Honourable Tim Grosser.
Mr. Speaker, as far as damaging the Canadian sensitivities, I have come across an article by a very senior Canadian political leader called Martha Ann Finlay, senior enough, I believe, to contest the leadership of the Liberal Party. It wouldn't mean much in the Labor Party context. Which says, quote, why Canada's dairy industry supply management is so flawed. So this is a matter for debate within and outside of Canada, and it is in the middle of a negotiation.
Supplementary question.
Supplementary question, the right honourable.
In the interest of introducing Mr. Parker to the adult world, when will he take himself out of rumour talk about being the next ambassador to Washington, given his totally inappropriate use of the GCSB to spy on international associates of ours in the advancement of his own egotistical, narrow career?
Order.
Point of order.
Point of order, Gerry Brown.
Mr. Speaker, that might be a very entertaining question for Mr. Peters and his colleagues, but, sir, it is so wide of the mark to be unacceptable as a supplementary question.
Mr. Speaker, he did refer to, and he put it into question, the issue of being part of the adult world, and that's what I'm hanging my question on.
The question is certainly the... The first part of the question is certainly completely out of order. There's no ministerial responsibility. If the minister wanted to address the second part of the question, he can do so. And that was the bit about...
Mr. Speaker, happy to address the second part of the question. We have a process for investigating all of these issues. We'll wait and see what the Inspector General has to say on the matter.
More on our webpage, parliamenttoday.co.nz. I'm Hanea Ahu, and I'll be back with Tom Fruin and Rhys Lyon and another report from Parliament at the same time next week.